What's up, UXers? Today, I've got a replay episode for you that aired last June of 2020. This is my conversation with Aaron Leonard and Bob Kassenschak. We talked about ontology and knowledge graphs and taxonomy and metadata and all the very, very geeky things. I'm resurfacing this episode because, one, it's super freaking interesting, and two, because Aaron and Bob are actually, we're going to be hanging out again soon on June 10th. They're going to be at OUX Happy Hour. I can't say that they're going to be speaking, but it's going to be a really interesting happy hour. So basically what they're going to be helping out with is building a knowledge graph for OUX. So during this conversation, you can see that I am really grappling with understanding a knowledge graph, what it actually is, how it works. I definitely think I got somewhere, and I definitely understand it more now than what I did back in June of last year. But I really feel like I'm going to viscerally understand it on June 10th when Aaron and Bob, myself and the Orca process are going to be the guinea pig for actually taking a bunch of my structured content and seeing how we can get it into Synaptica and actually create a knowledge graph. So we'll see how far we get on June 10th. But I wanted to resurface this episode so you could get to know Aaron and Bob and hopefully sign up for that event. So let me just introduce Aaron and Bob. So they both lead taxonomists at Synaptica. They've worked together for years, and they've been very generous with their time. I did a workshop with them last year, and I was a participant in their workshop, and they spoke to me for almost 2 hours on this episode, and we've actually been meeting to figure out how to plan this happy hour. So they're wonderful people and super sharp about this. They're kind of leaders in their industry when it comes to knowledge graphs. So in this episode, we talk about folksonomies and taxonomy and kind of the balance and between structure and flexibility. We talk about upper and lower ontologies. And the last 20 minutes gets actually like a little heated. It's pretty funny re-listening to it because we're just trying to figure out terminology. So we cut down a total rabbit hole on attributes and metadata and taxonomy and all our different definitions for these things. Before we jump in, I just want to give a few updates on the Orca process that is coming out of the OUX forum. So this is a new segment that I started in the last episode, and I'm going to start adding in. Again, give me feedback. Tweet at me if you're like, no, I don't want to hear these updates. But basically any kind of evolutions or enhancements that the community is working on. So for those of you that don't know what the Orca process is, it's a 15-step framework for iterating on your structure. And it's the process I teach in the OUX masterclass. It's the process I use with my clients. So ORCA stands for Objects, Relationships, Calls to Action, Attributes, and it consists of these four iterative rounds, each round hitting on the O, the R, and the C, and the A. So I have two updates for you today. So one is we have an updated CTA matrix. We've got a better where column, which is kind of like better values in there. We've got some drop lists with some logic so that you can go to a different tab and update the values in the drop list. It's pretty cool. So that is it's a Google Sheet that'll be linked in the show notes for our updated CTA matrix template. And the second thing I want to point your attention to is a better junction object explainer. This is just a little Loom video that I made that seems to have helped a bunch of people in the forum understand junction objects a little bit better. So actually in this episode, we talk about relationships having metadata. And I think at the time of this recording, I was just starting to kind of get into the value of junction objects and figure out how to leverage junction objects. And it seems like, I don't know, the more I teach junction objects, the more they show up everywhere. So if you're still fuzzy on that, or you have no idea what a junction object is, check out that link as well. So it's a very informal little video that will help you kind of in, you know, just kind of screen sharing some diagrams on how I sort of fix data problems with junction objects. Okay. And also, of course, in the show notes is going to be the link to the meetup, to the happy hour on June 10th. That's June 10th, 2021. And that's going to be a really fun live conversation slash live demo of actually seeing a knowledge graph come to life. Hopefully, fingers crossed. All right, enjoy the conversation, and I will hopefully see you on June 10th. Welcome to the Object-Oriented UX Podcast, a podcast about tackling complexity head-on, gracefully organizing massive amounts of information, and designing scalable, future-proof, and of course, naturally intuitive object-oriented user experiences. An OUXer is a powerful blend of information architect, business analyst, facilitator, and UX strategist. If this sounds like you or what you aspire to, you are so in the right place. I'm Sophia Prater, UX designer, chief evangelist of Object-Oriented UX, and your host. Let's jump into it.
I feel like we're old friends because I feel like I know you guys a lot from the workshop last week, but you don't really know me, but that's okay. We'll kind of get to know each other during this call. So if you want to just kick it off for those that don't know you, and I don't really know much about your background. You talked about it a little bit during the Information Architecture Conference, but I'm really curious to hear from you, like, how does somebody get into the world of ontology management software? What kind of person gets into this world, and what was your path getting there? And we can just start with you, Aaron.
Oh, yeah, great. Yeah, it's interesting. I think it comes from all kinds of backgrounds. You see a lot of people from library science who get into this space. My path was, I think, unique. And there's a book out there called The Accidental Taxonomist, and I think a lot of people are accidental taxonomists. They don't plan to do this. They fall into it one way or another. So for me, I have an English degree. I have a master's degree in English. I was an English teacher, and I wanted a career change, so I started applying for jobs, and the Modern Language Association was hiring for work in their bibliography, and the job was an assistant thesaurus editor, and I applied for it, and I had an interview, and then in the interview, I literally told them, I have no idea what this job is that I've applied for. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. Is it like Roget's thesaurus? What's going on? So they kind of...
Did you ask them to give you some synonyms?
I didn't even know enough at the time. I didn't even know enough. I'm like, I don't know what's happening here. So I got the job, and I always call that my taxonomy kindergarten. It's where I learned about controlled vocabularies. They had a thesaurus of 56,000 terms, which was alphabetized, and it was in, I believe it was in Microsoft Access, if you can believe it. Oh, no, it was in Notes. It was in Notes. And so you had to know the field. You had to know the humanities. And so if you knew things, you knew how they were connected. So there was no sense of hierarchy. There was concepts, and they were related to other concepts, and it was a true thesaurus, but you literally had to know what you were doing. So indexers use those terminology to index humanities articles. And as a thesaurus editor, you were checking to make sure they were using the right concepts and you were adding. So everything I learned about taxonomy came from there. And then this was about 2005. And if you look at the Gartner hype cycle for taxonomies, that was the peak of expectations for taxonomies. And I realized, why am I doing this for a nonprofit when I could be doing this for a consulting company and making a lot more money? So I made the switch over into consulting, and I've been doing that ever since.
Awesome. And that's an amazing background. That's a really cool story. And Bob, I got a little bit from your LinkedIn that you kind of started out more in writing, that you were a writer. Is that correct?
Sort of. So I started out, I went to a small liberal arts college and got a classical education. And then I actually worked in information as my first non, you know, waiting tables job for a classical music magazine doing cataloging. And there was no talk of the word taxonomy, but we were doing library science, even though I wasn't a library scientist. And then I went back to school for music. I got a master's degree in music. And then I... went to Texas and started working on a PhD in music. And then I turned 35 and decided I had made a terrible life choice because they do not make jobs for people like that anymore. You can literally make more money managing a Wendy's than you can as an adjunct professor. So I got out and spent some time doing freelance writing and editing, that sort of, you know, wordy, nerdy person freelance stuff. Worked for a content mill for a while. That was terrible. We moved back to New Mexico about 9 years ago, 9, 10 years ago. And I was casting around for something to do and answered an ad in the paper, sort of like Aaron. It was on Craigslist. And landed at a little taxonomy shop and learned the trade and found that I had actually some experience in the field and an affinity for it. So taxonomy software, but also taxonomy development and creation. So I've built a ton of taxonomy scope, taxonomy projects, project management around taxonomies. And that's, yeah, so I also learned the trade that way. It's as the accidental taxonomist. I would say about half the people in the field that I know come from library science backgrounds, and the other half are a complete mishmash, like me and Aaron, English majors, all kinds of people. Sometimes they come from content, sometimes they come from just necessity, like, okay, you're our taxonomist now, and people are like, taxon, what? Yeah, so I've been doing it for about 9 years. Yeah, that's how we landed. And then I think the world of taxonomy opens up into the world of ontology pretty quickly.
Yes, we're definitely going to be talking about those terms, and I'm going to be really picking those apart, because as a UX designer and a UX designer that is basically an information architect, I still have problems with those terms. But I'm curious, Bob, do you feel like your background in music, did that play into your work as a taxonomist?
So besides the obvious case of any time that there was a taxonomy about music, which I got to do a couple of times. Sort of. I mean, there's analysis. I was a music theorist, so I did analysis and dissecting complex systems to try and simplify them and make sense of them and describe how they were constructed. I mean, music is data, if you think about it in a certain way. It's not a very glamorous, emotional way, but music is information. So I think there's some synergy there, but definitely the analysis background plays into it.
Right. That's what I was thinking about music being data.
And I think the commonality there is, too, is a lot of people that are in this field are word people. They come from writing. They come from, not always, but you get a lot of English major backgrounds. You get people who are interested in the written word and making sense of it. And so coming from an English background like I did, you're always analyzing text and getting the meanings out of it. And so you get linguists and you get English majors who are interested in this field because they like words and they like to make sense of words.
Well, and part of that too, I think, Aaron, is that like when you first sort of describe taxonomy to someone, it sounds rather easy, right? You have food, and under food you have breads, and under bread you have some kind of bread. And it's like, oh, well, we just organize these things. But you really have to tease out the meaning in things and be specific about terms and be specific about how, in terms and context. Taxonomies are not very portable necessarily from institution or organization or business to another, even though it describes the same field. Like, a term over here might not be what people call it over here. It has an entirely different set of subtle connotations that that make it very difficult. And so as soon as you get down into the weeds, you start really coming to grips with the contextual meaning of words.
Right. And as somebody that is obsessed with labels, and I'm kind of like the label police sometimes, that's I saw Bob, that one thing that you did in the past is you helped create vocabularies for companies, which sometimes I feel like one of the most valuable things that I bring to a company is building them a glossary of these are the terms. Here's these six different terms that you guys were all using for the same thing. Now, here's your preferred term. Now, start calling it this so you guys can communicate better. And here's a bunch of terms where everybody was basically, instead of calling the same thing different things, you're calling different things the same thing. And doing a mix of that, making it nearly impossible for you guys to communicate around a complex domain and build good software. So I actually, though, funny enough, I'm a really terrible writer. I actually hate writing, but I like getting to the words and the labels. So right now, you guys are both senior managers at Synaptica, and I definitely want to talk more about Synaptica in a few minutes. But for what you do today, so that's a little bit of your background. For what you do today, how do you describe to this your job to people at dinner parties and family gatherings, to a cousin you've never met before?
Yeah, that's always the challenge. You try and get your elevator pitch for your career. And to this day, I have family members. I've been doing this for decades and they still have no idea what I do. And so I try to simplify it and I say, you know, when you go to your social media and you want to check in someplace and that list of things comes up and you look at it and you say, well, here's one for San Francisco International Airport, and here's one for SFO, and here's one for SFO United Lounge, and there's 20 different options, and you don't know which one to pick because you just want to check into the freaking airport. That's what I do. And they kind of go, oh, okay, so you kind of sort those terms out. I'm like, yeah, more or less. I mean, that's the simplified version, but that's usually how I try to make it easy and understand that we kind of deal in metadata and we kind of deal in terminology and making it regular.
Yeah, I think it. I vary my elevator pitch depending on the audience. Sometimes I just tell them I sell software. Just leave it at that. But my pitch actually revolves around social media. So people understand that you can hashtag something, right? So you can go and watch a video and say, all three of us watched some videos on YouTube about horses. And you can tag a video and like, right, hashtag something. And they're like, yeah, hashtag. I'm like, okay, hashtag, right. So you watch a video and you watch a video and I watch a video. They're all about horses. And I tag mine equestrians because I'm a taxonomist jerk. And Aaron tags his, OMG, look at the pretty white horsey, 111. And you tag yours horses. So when I go to retrieve all the videos about horses, if I look for hashtag horses, I don't get the ones he tagged and the ones I tagged. And they're like, okay. So I'm like, so the game is to produce a set of controlled tags that are the only tags people that are allowed to use so that when you go to retrieve the videos about horses, you get all the videos about horses and only the videos about horses or something, some version of that story. And they seem to understand. I mean, everyone has bad search experiences, right?
Right. So have you ever heard the term folksonomy?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yes. What do you think about the term folksonomy?
You know, that was like a lot of terms in the space. It gains some credence. It becomes a thing. You know, it's very like, huggy. I don't know how to describe it. You know, it's very warm and fuzzy, right? Like, oh, let's all do folksonomy together. Yay, that sounds great. It has its merits. I think it was a bit of a trend. And there is something to it. Getting a bunch of people together to agree on terms in one way or another is a foundational kind of activity in building taxonomy. So there's something to it. This idea that taxonomies would magically form by themselves out of people doing and agreeing on tags, that was the part that broke down, is mm-hmm. these taxonomies didn't just, not everybody just agreed and said, oh, boom, we have a taxonomy. You would start to see coalescing around common concepts and say, here's a term we can all agree on. So it had its merits. And I think that has, folksonomy as a concept has kind of faded in the taxonomy world, even though we're still kind of doing it. You get in a workshop and you say, let's all agree on a term. That's a folksonomy.
I think I agree is that folksonomy has become, and has always been part, but has become a way to gather terms to build a taxonomy. So if I go into an organization and they have nothing. Well, that's not actually true. They do have something. They have the way things are arranged on their websites, the way people arrange their files. They have back of the book indices and tables of contents. They have glossaries like you were talking about. They have stuff laying around. They have little bitsy bits of taxonomies all over the place. And there's two, I always say there's three places when I'm developing a taxonomy from scratch for an organization. And one is what stuff you have laying around. It's, taxonomies are like teapots, right? Everyone has a teapot in their house. They might not even know where it is, but everyone's definitely got one in a cupboard somewhere and maybe more than one. So you use those sources. And then another source you can use is to go directly to the content. If you have, I used to do a lot of work in scholarly and association publishing. So everyone has just piles, hundreds of thousands or millions of articles. You can go to the content, do some text mining and say, okay, well, let's just take all the titles of a million documents. What word? We throw out the thes and the ands and the ofs. What words and phrases are used? The other source is the people. How do you describe things? What do you do? And that's where the sort of folksonomy / workshop approach comes in, where you get the people together and say, let's tease out of you using various methods, card sorting, term suggesting, and put all those things in a box. And then, but they really still need to be sorted out. That's not a taxonomy. It's just an unsorted pile of hashtags. You still have the same problem if you don't apply some discipline and structure to it. So it's an important source. Go ahead.
So let's go back to some definitions and labels for those that are listening that might be wondering what a folksonomy is, what an ontology is, what a taxonomy is. And starting just to segue, just starting with folksonomy, because my understanding of a folksonomy is that's what the hashtags on Twitter and Instagram are. That would be a folksonomy. So I see you guys nodding. Okay. But it's interesting to think that a folksonomy is kind of what any institution already has sort of in the, you know, if you like open up all the closets, then you're going to see a folksonomy there that needs to be sort of organized into the taxonomy.
I'd say yes and no to that. Only I'd make a distinction. So a lot of people use SharePoint. And if they know SharePoint in those terms, there are terms in the term store and those are controlled. Those are, somebody came up with that and said, hey, we all got together in a meeting and decided this was the term. So there may have been some folksonomy background to build up that term. But really, they also have this freewheeling thing called enterprise keywords. And that's where you just go make up whatever and you put a hashtag in front of it and you just throw things out there. So there's sort of different levels of folksonomy. There's folksonomies that are more guided, where you throw out some structure, you throw out some ideas, you already have some things preceded. And then you have a folksonomy where there's just kind of nothing. So an organization has a mix of all of those things, I think. There's those random wild hashtags and they've got misspellings and there's 39 variants of the same thing because somebody decided to, well, one of them's plural and one of them's got an underscore in it and it's all just the same concept. And then you've got the ones where somebody put a little work into and they made a list, they made a glossary. They, you know, they've got a PDF somewhere and it's the official vocabulary that they want to use, but then it's been replicated and changed 300 times and spread around the organization. That stuff always exists. And taxonomy work is really about pulling that stuff together and getting it organized and saying, here it is. Here's the definitive version that we've agreed upon. And we want you to use this as the source of truth.
But then I think people and organizations quickly discover that, as a UX designer, you'll know exactly what I mean. As soon as you have more than a handful of things, you need to impose some structure on. If you got 8 things in a list, you're fine. If you got 20 things in a list, now we need to impose some structure on it because you can't take it in at a glance. So a tag cloud style folksonomy, even if you've resolved the duplicate concepts, you just still have a cloud of tags you can use, starts to become unhelpful when you get a dozen or 20 things. Not to say anything about 36,000 things, because there's no structure. If I have 100,000 papers about math and I have a math taxonomy, tagging those papers with math is singularly unhelpful. They're all about math. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't really help. And the next thing you need is that linear algebra is a subdiscipline of algebra. So papers tagged with linear algebra are also implicitly or explicitly tagged with algebra. So if I look under algebra, I also want the ones about linear algebra. So if you don't have any hierarchical organization, which is where taxonomy starts to evolve from ordered list of concepts. So where anything in subcategory also is in category explicitly. And when you start to have, again, more than 8 or 10 things, you have to start to impose that structure. Because if I look for all the papers on dogs and I don't get the papers about collies because the collie papers don't imply dogs, then your content retrieval is garbage.
So do you feel like there could be a gradient between having a folksonomy and having a taxonomy? And sometimes you're somewhere in between that, or is there even like a strategy on figuring out how much do we structure the content and how much do we leave it flexible and let the taxonomy be user generated in some key places? Is that part of your work on deciding where it can be flexible?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you know, we have made diagrams, and I know that in the field, other people have made diagrams where you sort of, you show this arrow, this continuum. And over on the left, you have wild, uncontrolled things. And over on the right, you have ontologies. And it's sort of this notion that you progress from one to the other. And that's not really true. You don't just start with one thing and then you know, the pinnacle is an ontology. It's like anything else. And you typically do use a mix. And I would say that's really true. I've worked in organizations where I've been part of the knowledge management. And knowledge management as a discipline tends to be a little looser. They want people to be able to do the thing they need to do on the fly. And if this person's job is different than this person's job, then it is not right for you to impose a taxonomy on that person and make them choose something. So usually they do work in tandem, where in one place, it must be tagged with this in order to make sense of it. Think of a ticketing system in an organization where somebody opens a ticket. Man, you've got to categorize it. You can't just put them all into other. They don't know what to do with it, right? It's got to be, okay, I have a particular issue and it falls into this taxonomy. I've classified it so that people can act on it. But in other places, yeah, let them freewheel. Let them just throw out hashtags. Let them just stick whatever in there, because then eventually all those hashtags will start to coalesce. You throw out the garbage. After a year, you've got a bunch of terms that you can stick into your taxonomy. And so it's an evolution.
That's the key point, is that with an organization or a content set of a certain size, the role of the taxonomist is to watch terms evolve and watch terms change and then and make adjustments accordingly. So you have to be, you have to let people freewheel and then gather those things and then refine them and add them over time. But you can't make it everyone's job to do that. They'll go crazy. And furthermore, they just won't do it. So if one role of a taxonomist in an enterprise type organization can be just the one behind the scenes saying like, okay, every month I'm going to review all the freewheeling tags, gather them together, resolve them, put them in the taxonomy, replace them in the content. And then it's all just done behind the scenes and they don't have to worry about it. Now, that said, there is a give and take between the taxonomist, who's an expert in vocabularies, and the subject matter experts, who are generally not taxonomists, but are the ones with who no one who's not in a field reads the journals in a field, right? If you've ever tried to read the journals in a field outside your discipline, it's overwhelming. And so only someone who's in a field is going to know that, oh, everyone was calling it X until last year when Dr. Jones wrote this famous paper that was hugely influential, and now everyone's calling it Y. So you need that input from the subject matter experts to give a push and pull with the taxonomist.
And there's another component here too, which is this dimensionality. It's time. You know, there's the temporal aspect of taxonomy. There's a notion that you just go and you build it and it's done. And when you look at folksonomies, time is required because you have to have user input. You have to have people put into it, and then you have to do something with it. And so there's no sense of being done with the taxonomy because terms change and things evolve. And so there's this huge time component of building this dimension into it. And expanding things over time. When I mentioned that I started the Modern Language Association, that vocabulary was really old and people would surface terms and you're like, wow, that's really ancient history. And I don't really think there was some very unpolitically correct terms in this thesaurus. People would dig things up and you're like, I don't think we can say that anymore. It's not. But at the same time, it was used. It was used for indexing. So you can't just throw it away. You have to link back to it. You have to take your new term and say, this is now the replacement for the old term we no longer use. And you can see that in common parlance. Look at a speech done by Martin Luther King in the 60s. The terminology is not what we use today. But we need to be able to link back to those same concepts.
Well, I was kind of picturing when we were talking about this balance between the folksonomy and the taxonomy and how it kind of goes back and forth. I was picturing Bill Buxton's Christmas tree of diverging and converging, which in UX design we often use to get to a solution. So create a bunch of concepts and then kind of bring those concepts together and then create more concepts and bring it together until you get to the end of the Christmas tree, the point of the Christmas tree. So I'm seeing it as similar, where you have that structure and then you sort of let it out into the wild and it gets a little messy and then you kind of bring it back in, but it becomes more relevant and more timely as you continue to pull it together. So what I think is what I'm juxtaposing that with is the difference between that and an ontology. Because if you think about those different layers of speed, I'm thinking about, actually, I think it was Carrie Haynes' workshop that I went to after y'all's workshop. She talked about how domains, and I don't know if she used the word ontology, but basically this information architecture structure changes slowly. While you have it, and then at the very top, you have fashion or design or trends that change very quickly. So I often say information architecture is not as iterative as something like visual design, where you have trends and you're changing it on the surface, right? So I'm thinking about, how does that compare when you think about an ontology? Is that, to you, does that feel like something that there's more of a source of truth that changes slowly versus terms and taxonomy that changes more quickly?
I wouldn't draw the distinction there between taxonomy and ontology, but the pace, you're absolutely right. Taxonomies or ontologies lag. They have, unless you are just automatically updating it on the fly, and there's not as much human curation, even though there should be, then you can update them more quickly. But yeah, there's a huge difference, and I think that's where you still get that whole tagging element. I can go on Facebook or whatever social media place, and I can just make up a tag. And is it in the taxonomy? Probably not yet, and it may be. So these structures always lag behind. Really, what I see the difference in terms of time is that taxonomies take planning, but ontologies, we kind of divide things into the known knowns and the unknown unknowns, and there's so many unknown unknowns when you go to develop a taxonomy or ontology. You don't know what your business is going to be doing a year from now. You could merge with another business. You could change the direction that your business is going. So this idea that you can build the perfect taxonomy or ontology up front, you're not going to be able to do that. You have to build it to the best of your ability, let it evolve. But both take a lot of planning up front. Try and get it to the best place you can.
It also seems like there is, because we're not UX designers, but we are, in a sense, information architects, I think. We just come at it from a different part of the information architecture than you do. But I was talking with Ren Pope, who I know you know, and he has some slides or metrics or something where he goes in to do an evaluation for someone, and he's like, yeah, you know, if you consider the UX first, it's actually a lot cheaper than if you bring it in as a patch later to fix problems. You have to be a really enlightened organization to bring in your taxonomy or even an ontology first. Be like, well, we're developing an e-commerce site. We need to get a taxonomist up in here. Usually it's like, oh shit, we've created a massive mess. We need to get some taxonomy up in here. And it's really very rare to see someone start from the position that, hey, we're going to do content strategy. Okay, as part of the content strategy, there's categories. Okay, well, that's a thing. And then they just sort of like, we'll deal with that later. Where if someone could be convinced to bring it in on the front end, it affects the UI, it affects the search experience, it affects so many kinds of things.
That's so true. It's an amazing project when taxonomy or ontology or any of this kind of modeling can happen right from the beginning and you're not playing catch up. I mean, that's those are the best projects when they say, we're going to do a content management system. We're going to install one, or we've got a new digital asset management system, or we're launching a new website, whatever the use case is, to be able to say, and yeah, we better have UX right now. And we've got to have taxonomy now, right from the beginning, and let them develop in parallel. One of the best projects I ever worked on was for a state organization in which they knew they had to have all these things. And we were literally, they were doing agile development, and I was working in an IT team. I'm not really an IT person. And I was embedded in the IT team. I felt like I was a journalist going out in the war zone or something, embedded, because these guys were totally different. And I'm like, I'm learning agile as we go. I don't do Scrum. I don't know what's happening here, but I'm in the mix. And we're literally including taxonomy as part of the agile development. Like, we're going to develop this technical component, and you're going to work on the taxonomy that goes with that. And that was a fantastic, amazing project, because it was unusual to have all these things come together in one place. It was excellent.
Guys, we've got to define ontology. We've got to do it. The scariest word in information architecture. So I'm actually going to give you what I think it is, and then you tell me if I'm wrong. Okay. So my understanding from your workshop and from doing a little bit more research is ontology is very similar to your domain model. Your ontology model and your domain model, you could use those interchangeably.
You can use an ontology that way, and that's certainly one example of an ontology is to model a domain. That's completely
which is
valid.
And just to get back up is the domain model. That's basically what are all the objects or the things in the domain and how do they relate to each other?
And how do they relate? Now, that might include a taxonomy of concepts that are applied to parts of the domain model. So let's say I'm going to take an example again from the world of scholarly and academic publishing. So I have a bunch of content. My content's an XML. I have a taxonomy. I tag the content. That's not a domain model or an ontology. The domain model says I have objects that are papers. Those papers have authors. Those authors are affiliated with institutions. Those papers have references to other papers that have authors who are affiliated with institutions. Paper has a unique digital object identifier number. So all these things have unique object identifiers that we can relate. And the papers have topics that they're tagged with from a big 10,000 word thesaurus. Now I can infer if you write about a topic that you also have that topic, right? So I can infer your expertise from the papers that you write. Now I have something like an ontological domain model where I have a bunch of objects in the system. And now we can expand that. Now you're a user, you go read a paper. Now, does that mean you're interested in that topic? Probably. But if you read 10 papers that all have the same tag or from the same branch of tags, now I can infer something about what the user's interested in. And I can recommend other content to them based on the tagging from the taxonomy in the domain model of the ontology of the entire ecosystem. And then furthermore, you can build a graph, which isn't necessarily a knowledge graph, but a graph model of like, and Scopus does this, papers that cite other papers that cite other papers that cite other papers. And now I can do things that are cool, like say, hey, Sophia and Aaron both write on this topic, but they don't have the same co-author pool. They cite the same things, but they never work together and they don't work with the same authors. So now we can start to connect dots mm-hmm. that are there that aren't being connected in the graph because there's so much similarity in the shape of the model. So that I think is an excellent example of a way to understand an ontology. Another way to understand it is there's various names for this, but there's what people call upper and lower ontologies. The upper ontology is the model with no data in it. It's papers and authors and how they relate to each other, but there's no authors attached to it. There's no papers right. attached to it, just the modeling process. And then when you add the information from it, now you have something more like a full-blown ontology, ontologically modeled structure or something like that.
So my understanding was that there was the ontology was that model, that idea that here's the different types of objects and here's how they relate. And then when you get into the knowledge graph, that's when you start filling up that ontology with content, where now you actually have stuff within that ontology.
I think the irony here, of course, is that the terms. So after reading your article, Sophia, I think you totally have the concept. I think you're an accidental ontologist. I think you get it. I think you totally get it, but it's the terminology, which of course is ironic. For me, an ontology, so echoing what Bob said, that there's this model, and the key to me is this idea of a domain, that you have a domain or domains of knowledge, and you want to model how those things connect. And those things can be concepts, or they can be concepts to actual real things. And that might be a document, or it might be a web page. The key is that domain. And echoing what Bob said about the upper and lower ontology. So an upper ontology really is that model to say, we've thought about what things need to be connected. We've thought about how they were going to be connected. And then it's up to you to plug in the instances, fill in what those things are. And sometimes that thing, so there's this concept that everything is of equal importance. And so an object is just as a first-class citizen just as much as relationship or the content that you are linking to. So you have this idea of the model of the ontology, and then you sort of fill that up with concepts. And a lot of those concepts are just labels. They're not a thing per se. They've got a URI, they're an actual object, but it's those concepts that need to go out and connect to content in the world. And I think that's when you start to bridge between an ontology, which is really kind of an abstraction, like a taxonomy. Like a taxonomy, you can put it in an Excel spreadsheet and it looks beautiful, but it doesn't do anything when it's locked up in that Excel spreadsheet. It sits there. And the same thing with an ontology. You can model it in software and it can look beautiful and you can visualize it, but does it do anything? And that to me is when you start getting into the knowledge graph where, well, now it's connected to outside content and now it's starting to make recommendations because you're following and traversing the model. That's when you start to get into the knowledge graph, is that it's actionable.
So I guess for me, and we've been going to this Stanford course about knowledge graphs and listening to people talk about it, and there's a lot of disagreement about what it is. So to me, the model I described, where I have papers and authors and topics and all those things modeled, that's still an ontology and not quite a knowledge. You could express it in a graph and you could query it like a graph. So some people would call it a graph. To me, to really complete that picture, what you need to do is take, let's say, each of those topics in your taxonomy and connect them to some outside data source. So now I'm talking something more like a Google knowledge graph, so that if I go to search for all the papers about nonlinear optics, not only do I get the papers about it and the authors who publish on the papers and the journals and the people who have departments, but I get some kind of a definition about nonlinear optics that links to other sources. Here's the Wikipedia article. Here's some Google links about it. Here's some pictures. Here's some more information external to my system that, so the, as I said in the workshop, the genius of the Google knowledge graph is that you don't have to do anything to access it. You just run a search. I run a search on Brad Pitt. I get web pages about Brad Pitt. I get his IMDb page. I get his official website or whatever, if he has one, I don't know. Maybe I get his Twitter feed. Mm-hmm. And then I get a card that has his birth date, his Wikipedia article, who he's married to, what his birthday, da-da-da-da-da, all this information. So it's reaching out and using linked data principles and the semantic web to grab information. Because, and in order to do this, you have to do some pretty foundational work, which can be painstaking, to make those connections. If you have 10,000 entities, you can go scrape a site and try and equate them all with URIs that you think are the equivalent. But you know, you need to check those. So I think we're quibbling about where we draw the line between ontology and knowledge graph, but it's really that like ability to bring in information outside your system to enrich the information that's inside your system. Mm. So you know, I'm not just searching for content in my system that's about a topic. I'm also providing other information. Maybe I'm saying, you know, here's five other journals that publish on this topic or something like that.
Isn't that just a CMS with really great APIs?
I would draw a distinction. CMS is just a place where that could happen.
Okay.
That's good.
You know, I mean, a content management system is, I like to think of it as a place. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got a database and it's got a UI and that's really frequent to use in a, so an organization needs to have a content management system, and sometimes they use file shares, which isn't great, but they still use them. And maybe they invest in a content management system, whichever one that may be. And that's such a great landing place for a person, because I wouldn't want to see your average user go into our software on the UI front end. It's not for them. We're back end stuff. We're okay. We're plumbing. It's not very nice way to talk about our own software, but really we're plumbing, right? You don't walk into a house.
I like to say middleware. It sounds better than plumbing.
you don't walk into a house and say, "Man, I can't wait to see what kind of plumbing is installed in this." You look at the house and you know, oh, it's beautiful and it's got a great location and look at it. It's got, you know, it's got so many bedrooms, it's got a pool, it's got these things. You don't look at the plumbing until you have to really make sure the house is sound. And that for me is where the taxonomy ontology, it's plumbing. And if you're not a taxonomist, you're not an ontologist, you're not a nerd, you don't care about these things, it exists to help you. You get into the content management system to find your content and query it and add new stuff and pull stuff out of it and maybe connect to other things. You're not concerned with how that's all happening on the back end. It's the landing place for you to go as a user to make sense of it all,
so,
and to get the experience.
Would it be accurate for me to say you want to build, design a very strong ontology to inform the design of your CMS? Your CMS should sort of reflect that ontology. And then the knowledge graph is where the, or the CMS is the place where the knowledge graph lives.
I think it definitely can, because knowledge graphs, you know, as Bob was saying with the Google, the genius of the Google knowledge graph is that anybody with any kind of technology, if you have a browser and you have a decent internet connection, you have a knowledge graph and you can get to it. And that's amazing. They also have the benefit of billions of searches a day and thousands of employees and hundreds of thousands of algorithms and who knows how many servers they have in the world. They've got the benefit of scale. In an organization, you kind of have to funnel that through your a content management system or something like that, a place to go, a UI. You don't get the benefit of that scale except whatever is being done in your organization. But yeah, I think that you, the underpinnings are still there. It's just smaller, more localized, and tailored to the organization that it's fit to.
And for those, just to real quick define the Google Knowledge Graph for those out there that don't know what we're talking about, that's, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's basically, that Google Knowledge Graph is manifested in that right-hand card when you do the search and you search Brad Pitt and you see all the search results on the left, and then you see the Brad Pitt card that links him to all of his movies, the IMDb site, other search results. That's the knowledge graph coming. That's the knowledge graph manifested.
Right. And they're adding to it, right? You see these top boxes where it's local weather conditions, or it's, you know, it's pertinent to where you are, depending on the, if it knows your browser and it knows where you're located and it localizes things, that's also part of that knowledge graph too.
Yeah. So that's a good point. If you go search for broccoli, you'll get some information about broccoli and a card about broccoli. If I search for pizza, the first results I get are pizza restaurants near me. So your browser, as long as you don't have, you know, one of these anonymous browsers turned on, is trying to deliver what it thinks are the most accurate results. So if I'm and furthermore, that's predicated on other searches that you've done. If you let it save it, which people get freaked out about because they're like, well, we're living in information bubbles. We all do the same search, we get different results. But if I'm a naturalist and you're a football fan and I search for Panthers and I get big cats and you search for Panthers and you get a football team in Carolina, that's because it knows what kind of stuff we search for and it's tailoring the results to us. I was going to use West Jaguar World. Because of the car too. Yes, Westworld. So, I mean, I guess what I'm... So in a knowledge, in an ontology, of which I think a knowledge graph is a special case, in an ontology, everything's an object. The objects are objects and the relationships are also objects. Every object can have properties and they can all have relationships. So this comes back to what you practice or advocate in object-oriented UX. And I'd like to hear a little more about how this, I know you have more stuff you want to ask us, but I think we've come around to this naturally. I'd like to hear you say, like, how does this inform or expand your sort of concepts of your practice?
Hey, y'all, just a quick interruption. As of this recording, we are in the midst of cohort 4 of the OUX certification, and enrollment for cohort 5 won't open up until early summer 2021. But you can dig into all the certification video content, all the templates, all the resources by grabbing access to the OUX Masterclass. And if, after going through the Masterclass, you want to get certified, you'll be able to apply the cost of the Masterclass to your enrollment in Cohort 5. So you can kind of think about it like a down payment. Once you enroll in the Masterclass, you'll get access to the OUX Academy, and over the course of 10 weeks, about 2 to 3 hours of video lectures will be released to you each week. But you can consume that content totally at your own pace. You'll have lifetime access to it. So if it takes you 20 weeks to go through it, that's totally fine. You're not just gonna get video content. You're gonna get checklists. You're gonna get exercises. You're gonna get assignments and tons of valuable resources. Basically everything you need to become an expert complexity wrangler. Again, you get everything that a certification cohort gets, just minus all those personal touches. the camaraderie of the cohort in the OUX forum, access to the OUX mentors, the one-on-ones with me, as well as me answering all your questions in the forum and in office hours, and of course, the actual certification and a profile on OUX.com. So for all of that, you'll need to actually join a cohort. But you don't have to wait. You can start becoming that complexity wrangling, stakeholder whispering, IA facilitator extraordinaire now. You can start saving yourself and your team countless hours of rework. And you can start saving your user from the extraneous complexity that OUX helps you avoid. So go to OUX.com/certification to learn more. From there, you can get on the waitlist for cohort 5, as well as get yourself access to that entire video library that is the OUX Masterclass. Still not sure if you're ready to take the plunge? Go check out the testimonials on OUX.com. Okay, back to the show.
Right. So when a big part of what I teach is domain modeling and system modeling. And the only distinction between that is the domain model is the big thing with all the domain objects, and the system model is just the objects that are relevant to your particular system, right? That might need to interact with domain objects outside of your system through potentially an API or something or another. It's good to understand the whole domain model, but I usually focus my students on that system model of the relevant objects. And then we do entity and relationship diagrams. Basically, I teach crow's feet diagramming and cardinality, so you understand one-to-many relationships, many-to-many relationships. And then we, after doing some thinking about functionality, what is the functionality around each of the objects, we go into structuring those objects, where we go into attributes. So really what I'm most interested in is getting that terminology right. So like what Aaron was saying is like, okay, Sophia, we need to get you to that correct terminology. So I want to make sure that I'm using these words right, which is, it's a real challenge because our industry is still figuring itself out. And we need to be having these conversations with each other more. So we're like, okay, you guys, the ontologists, and Sophia, the UX designer, BA/IA person, that we're kind of starting to agree on these terms. So one thing.
Well, it sounds like what you're doing is ontology, or at least what I would call something like ontological type thinking, even if you're not building a structure in OWL or RDF that you're going to put into a triple store. You don't have to do that, but you're using ontological thinking because you're understanding things as objects with relationships, both of which can have attributes and need to be normalized and codified in a schema. So just because you're not modeling it in an ontology tool or in RDF doesn't mean it's not ontological thinking.
Yeah.
And if it makes you feel any better, even within our discipline, people don't agree on these terms.
Yeah, well, yeah.
the term taxonomy has taken over to mean all kinds of controlled vocabularies, whether it's a flat list. And for somebody, so when I started, at the Modern Language Association, it was a thesaurus. It was not a taxonomy. And the reason it was a thesaurus is not only because it wasn't built in a hierarchy, but because it had related terms and it had used for terms and it had scope notes and it had everything as defined by the standard, which there's a standard for taxonomy and control vocabulary management out there called the Z39, right?
Z39-19.
Yeah, the ANSI NISO Z3919. So that's the standard, and that's what we lived by. That was our Bible, and we tried to adhere to that and use the standard. So even in this community, taxonomy kind of means all that, unless it's an ontology. But if you ask somebody who's, especially somebody who's gone through library science, they'll say, well, this is a taxonomy, versus this is a list, versus this is a thesaurus, versus this is an ontology. So I think we generally agree on the principles and the naming. But when you start getting into the details, it depends on the practitioner and just how deep they are into
it. But there's this sort of sense that you have like a controlled list, and then you impose hierarchy, and you have a taxonomy, and then you impose other kinds of relationships and fields, and you have a thesaurus, and then ... you have an ontology. And really, that's kind of a misconception. They're the earliest versions of ontologies were thesauri with extra relationships, so that I have so in a thesaurus I have a term that's a topic, and that term has three valid types of subterms: instantive, generic, and partitive. So if I have a dog, Lassie is an instance of a dog, a collie is a genre of a dog, and a leg of a dog as a part of a dog. But those are all just narrower terms. They're just NTs. They live on the same level of the hierarchy. There's no differentiation that they have any distinction of how they relate to dog. So the first, if you look at the early standards, the first ontologies, we're saying, okay, so narrow term partitive, narrow term instative, narrow term generic, we're going to tease out these relationships. That really doesn't have anything to do with what we were talking about the upper ontology and modeling. So that modeling of upper ontology is not an outgrowth of taxonomy. You can have a taxonomy that's straight concepts that you would use to label content or products or web navigation or something, and give it deeper relationships. But there's no, and that would be an ontological like structure, but it still doesn't have that upper level schema of the domain, of the objects, of the content, the people, the other things. So there's that sort of straight line from controlled list to ontology breaks between thesaurus and ontology, because an ontology is really a more complicated data model, taxonomies.
And really those ontologies too, you start to get those restrictions. And that's a real differentiator. So in a taxonomy, so you can basically model something in taxonomies that's a lot like an ontology. You say, well, each taxonomy, each structure is its own thing. And so we've got people and we've got organizations and maybe we have content types, right? And those are big generic buckets, and we can interrelate between those, and we start to think, oh, this is getting pretty complex, you know, and I'm relating these things between the facets. This is starting to look like an ontology. But really, when you get into ontology, it has these notion of classes and restrictions to say only this type of entity, of instance, can live in this, and it's constrained to that, and it constrains the logic, and it constrains the relationships you can have. And that's why when you get into very complex ontology. So one of our clients is in life sciences, and it's extremely complex because they're dealing with diseases, and they're dealing with drugs, and they're dealing with symptoms, and they're trying to interrelate these things based on these ontologies, and there's certain restrictions, and they need to be restricted. You can't just relate things to each other. They have to be constrained in a logical way. You know, and you think about it in the life sciences, it could literally be a matter of life or death how these ontologies are constrained and what kind of recommendations the ontology might be giving someone.
So could you say, so one thing that just blew my mind in the workshop last week was when we were talking about relationships having metadata. And one of the examples, I was like, what? How could no, the objects have the metadata. Relationships don't have metadata. You have a type of relationship. You have cardinality, so you can have different types of relationships and the different predicates, the different verbs. But then we started talking about the strength between the relationships. So, and that's true. Some relationships are stronger than other relationships. So there you go. Now you have metadata. You have a strength metadata put onto the relationship. And then another one that you just made me think of is potentially logic. So logic put onto those relationships. So these like if-then statements. So when is this relationship valid? These conditions have to be met for this relationship to be valid. Is that what you're talking about when you're talking about restrictions?
Yeah, I mean, those are some of the constraints in logic that has to be put into the classes to be able to say, a concept of this type that has been defined in this class or this domain. So a person can relate to an organization in these particular ways, and a person does not relate to another person in the same way. So you literally you're saying, well, there's only certain kinds of relationships that can exist, and they can only exist between certain kinds of concepts, you know, those classes. Yeah, I think that's...
Yes. Let's just talk about Synaptica for a second because, or more than a second. So you were talking about it being the plumbing or the middleware. And actually one of my questions was, is who are your users? What kind of people are using Synaptica?
There's the people that use it, and there's the systems that use it. The people who are using it are taxonomists and ontologists and some associated people. You know, there might be content people, there might be product people if it's a product taxonomy, but our our products are really enterprise level things that large organizations bring in to help control their vocabulary messes. So you're a Fortune 500 company and you're in a situation that we described earlier. You got people in HR and people in product and people in web design and people in this, and they all have spreadsheets with taxonomies in them. And we need a centralized place where we can store and govern these things and then distribute them to other systems. So from the UI end, the user's the taxonomist or whatever person is doing that type of work. But from a systems architecture standpoint, it really is plumbing. I mean, it's middleware. It sits in the middle of a stack, and other systems can pull taxonomies from it so that we don't have to have spreadsheet somewhere that people are tagging from. So you could surface it in the tagging application and UI and the library and search and stuff like that. Aaron, would you say that's...
Yeah, you know, and it depends on the role. I mean, you know, each organization is different. So taxonomy and ontology is not industry specific, obviously. You know, any kind of company could use it. And those roles within it, it's a matter of what they're touching and how, you know, Bob said this earlier. It's great when you find that person in the organization, no matter what they do, who really starts to geek out on taxonomies. You're like, all right, I have an ally. I have an advocate. And you embrace those people and you go sell this thing. And it's just a fact of life that a lot of people just don't care about taxonomy. They're not interested. They don't get it. They don't care about it. It's of no value to them. They don't want to know. So you have these different levels. You have the taxonomists and ontologists who are working in the system and they're trained to do it. And this is what they do. And sometimes you have part-time people. You find those advocates and they're like, oh, I want to do this. And so you get 10% or 20% of their time and they help contribute to the taxonomy as well. They contribute to it. Often you have content creators who use it, but they are customers of it. So right now, one of our clients, you have a whole team of taxonomists and ontologists. They're working in the system, but they're surfacing this taxonomy out to, they're using a Confluence wiki mm-hmm. for their content. And so those content creators are creating all this stuff in a wiki and they're tagging it up using this taxonomy. And they can see it and they know it exists, but they probably will never see the UI of our software. They only see it expressed in other systems. And selling taxonomy as a concept is hard.
Yeah, I was going to ask. And how I realized,
oh man, when you work in the organization. So I've been a taxonomist, and I've when I started to work for Synaptica, which is a vendor of taxonomy software, people who I knew in the industry were like, "Oh, I see you've gone to the dark side, right? Now I'm working for the company that's selling the software versus being the person who is looking to purchase that software." But it, you know, it's two sides of the same industry. When people are ready to make that shift into a taxonomy, it's good to pin it to something else. Because if you just say taxonomy, I think a lot of people, except for that small group, tune out. So I have worked in organizations where they said, we've got a content management system rolling out, plus taxonomy, add taxonomy. We need the software too. Doing it standalone, it can be done, but it's hard. You kind of have to pin it, obviously, to a use case, especially enterprise-wide. So I worked in one organization where knowledge management went straight up to the top. They had sold this right up to the C-level. And the president of the, I mean, it was like 20,000 people in this company. And he said repeatedly, knowledge management is important. So you've got a chain up to the C-level and you connect taxonomy and say, well, if knowledge management is important, taxonomy is important for knowledge management. Therefore, this is also connected all the way up. Mm. And that it can be a very hard sell to those who don't know, because you might get people who say, well, it's you just don't need that kind of infrastructure. You don't need to control those terms. Or each group in our company is fine making their own list. This is what they've been doing and we can continue to do this. Why change? So it can be really tough to sell it into a place. You need that champion.
And it's really, yes, the champion is critical, but and people are always looking for things like, well, what's the ROI on this? And that's really hard to quantify. But I've done some research. I think I just shared these with you like last week, Aaron, but I did some research and put together a presentation a couple years ago. Let's say you're just doing internal content management, right? This your problem to solve is just institutional knowledge management. There's a statistic, knowledge workers, which is a huge class of people in any organization, right? Knowledge workers spend on average something like 18% of their time looking for documents that they know exist, but they can't find them, so they recreate them. That means that like 8 hours out of every knowledge worker's week is completely wasted salary. Like, they could be doing work and they're looking for stuff that they know exists and they can't find it, so they make it again. And this happens over and over again. And so these slides have some other metrics like that, but it's about, you know, frustrations in search. Well, the very first IA summit I went to, so this is maybe 9 years ago or something, I went to a talk by Jared Spool, who I didn't know who he was at that point. So I went to this talk, it was like towards the end of the last day, and I was like, so his thing was like, he's like, I can't tell you who this customer was, but I did this project, and essentially the problem was that it was an e-commerce site. It could only have been like four or five things because it was some huge e-commerce site. And the problem was that people would go do their shopping, get to their cart, couldn't remember their login and password, and get frustrated and leave because there was no checkout as guest button. So they added a checkout as guest button, and they made $1 billion extra dollars the next year. And that was where I sort of went, like, where can we interrogate the pain points that are happening? I can't save you $1 billion tagging your content, but I can make your members more likely to re-up with your organization. You know, let's say you have a subscription or something, if they can find what they want versus they're just going to, you know, why pay for this service if your search is garbage?
Right.
And the ROI is always tangential. It's very hard to get that. I remember in one organization, I used the same kinds of papers and the same kinds of information. What we did was we said, okay, if this study is correct and somebody spends this much time looking for a document per week, let's find the most expensive resource in the company, okay, Ooh. Which were engineers, $350 an hour on average, right, was how much it cost to have these engineers. And we did this ridiculous math. You said, okay, well, we've got $350 an hour, you've got 8 hours a week spent searching, and you have whatever, 5,000 engineers. And we came up with this formula, and it's like, okay, so according to this, we're going to save your company $25 million or something outrageous. And we're like, that number is so preposterous. We literally had to just scrape the last three zeros off and say, okay, well, we're going to take 5% of that number or something because it was so outlandish. I mean, there was a truth to it. But when you did that kind of mechanism and said, if I'm paying somebody $350 an hour to look around for documents they can't find, and they're spending this many hours, how much money am I spending? And it's so hard to quantify that,
right,
even though it's true.
No, I love that. That's a I haven't heard that one. The one that I've used is borrowed from Bram Wessel of Factor Firm, who was on the podcast a few episodes ago, and he talks about the information layer. So you have the design layer on the top, and then you have the information layer, and then you have the technology layer. And he talks about how the technology layer is, I mean, you get good engineers, but that's not really where your competitive edge is going to be. And even the design layer is less and less about where your competitive edge is going to be. You know, you're just going to use UX best practices and you want to create a great user experience, but really where your company's value is and where it differentiates its value is in that information layer. Like, that is your asset. That's your main asset, is the information. And it's often the forgotten layer. All the money goes into the technology stack and the pretty shiny design. And then that go-between, the information, is often ignored.
Well, and so many companies are either driven by products or content, which is a kind of product, I guess, that those are your main assets. Products are data. Content is data. And being able to organize those things well, to your point, is critical. So if you have the shiniest UI of shiny UIs and all the best servers in the world, but the information is not organized in a way that people can get to it, like, that's worthless.
Right.
And people don't think about those connections. But I mean, look at the brilliant success of companies like Amazon. They've got a giant ontology team. Yes. I don't know how many people, 150 people, let's say. There's a lot. And they work on this, and there's a lot of automation. I mean, they're Amazon. They have a lot of money. They do a lot of high-tech kind of things. So there's a lot of automation, but there's always these humans in the loop. And that's part of their success, right, is to be able to say, we've modeled our taxonomies and ontologies in such a way and gotten those recommendations good enough that, I mean, how much on that long tail of, oh, what the heck, I'll throw one extra thing in there since you bring it up. How many of those sales do they do? It's just like it's a virtual end cap, right? You get to the grocery line, you're like, yeah, I'll buy a Snickers bar. Why not? It's sitting right there. I may as well. It's the same thing. They've done it virtually.
So I cannot believe that Amazon has 150 ontologists, and they all must be working on the one object of product and not other objects, because actually Amazon drives me crazy because how unconnected it is between the concepts. So one example that I give is you can be looking at the example I give is the Dirty Dancing soundtrack. So I can be listening to the Dirty Dancing soundtrack, which is a soundtrack object, and I'm listening to it on Amazon Music, of course. So for Amazon, it'd be like a completely different world, even though as a user, it's all the Amazon world to me. I'm in Amazon. So I'm listening to Dirty Dancing, and what object is not surfaced to me? The movie, actually. So there's no rent now button. I have to open up a new tab, search for Dirty Dancing, and then I can see that, oh, because I have Amazon Prime, I can actually watch Dirty Dancing for free. But while I'm listening to that soundtrack, it doesn't tell me that. It doesn't connect those. It does not connect those concepts. And there's so many examples of that on Amazon where the different types of content, I mean, and even products, I'm sure there's Dirty Dancing products, or think about Harry Potter. There's probably a Harry Potter product, and Harry Potter, the movies, are actually not connected within Amazon. And they're leaving probably millions, if not billions of dollars on the table because they're not doing that cross-linking between different types of objects.
It's interesting because I've seen things that were thematically tied where I've looked for something. Now, it seems to work better within a genre. If you like this album, you'll probably like this album. And 9 times out of 10, I say, yeah, actually, you're right. Yeah. I would like that album. Yeah. I think there's a connection there. But I do see sometimes across a general concept, if I'm searching for something, I'm a big geeky Star Trek fan. So I look up something from Star Trek and it's like, hey, here's a pizza cutter in the shape of the Enterprise, which actually exists. And I'm like, yeah, okay. I like that. That's so correct. I mean, because not only do I like the movies and the whatnot, I like a pizza cutter shaped like the Enterprise.
So there's sort of two poles of how to do recommendation, right? One is, thing A is very much like thing B. If it's content that has the same, 8 out of 10 of the same topical tags, it's the same object type, it has the same shape. The other one is people who looked at thing A also looked at thing B. And finding a balance between these things is very, very difficult, right? I think Amazon's algorithms still are biased towards the second one, and you can see that. It's more like people also bought. I mean, and there's problems with that, right? If I buy a pizza cutter, how many freaking pizza cutters do I really need? Maybe now I want a pizza stone. Maybe now I want a pizza oven. Maybe now I want a pizza caddy. Bob, I don't know.
Those are all products. And that's where I think the entire internet is biased toward what I call recirculating. So I'm just recirculating product to product to product to product to product. And I never cross over into a different object type.
And it creates loops.
And it creates these loops, but it doesn't create a true exploratory navigation that's based on those real world relationships. Like what I was talking about in the BBC article about how well they were cross-linking between chef and recipe and ingredient and diet. They did a really good job of that. And
BBC's been ahead of the curve on ontologies for a long time. They've done some really cool stuff.
Those ontologies have been out for a long time. That's right.
They had for a while, I don't know if it's still there. For a while, there was a BBC Wildlife website that was entirely run by linked data. No one created a web page. What they did was create these templates that were filled up by linked data links. So if I go look for cheetahs, I would get articles on cheetahs and blurbs about cheetahs and little videos on cheetahs and pictures of cheetahs. No one built that website. It would just go say, cheetah concept links to all these things, bring it all in. And they just had it modeled that way. So you could plug any animal in and it would automatically build a web page for you. So instead of building a web page for every animal, which is prohibitive, it just did it all via linked data, and it was super cool, and it was a great example to show people. Like, you can explain linked data to people and they're like, but if you show them something that actually works on that principle, that was a lot easier for them to understand. Now, I just want to go back for a second, having watched some presentations recently by people from Amazon, they are working on stuff like that, but they're also spending a lot of their time. They're already making money hand over fist on .com. So what they are spending a lot of their time with ontologists on, there's definitely lots of product taxonomy ontology going on, but they're also doing lots of work trying to build a massive ontology for their chatbots and personal assistants or whatever you want to call them. So that's much harder because you can't obviously display a list of results. You got to say, you know, Alexa, tell me a dog joke or whatever. Mm-hmm. And just as with Google, who we also watched some presentations on, there's a lot of human in the loop type stuff going on in what I guess is an analogy to the last mile problem, right? So in package delivery, the last mile problem is that getting the widget from Hong Kong to, you're in DC, right?
Atlanta.
Oh, Atlanta, that's right. I knew that. I haven't talked to Ren about it. So getting a widget from Hong Kong to Atlanta is not a big deal. Getting the widget from the airport to the distribution warehouse is not a big deal. Getting it from the distribution warehouse to your house on the truck is the most expensive part of that process. And the same thing is true with like Google search recommendation algorithms and Google Maps. There's an unbelievable amount of human curation that goes into Google Maps. That is not all automatically generated. Those little local bits and details, there are people reviewing and refining that stuff. Same with the knowledge graph. A ton of it, a ton of it is done automatically. There's a lot of human in the loop in the analogous last mile.
Personalization is still hard, still, for all the brilliance of these things that have connected, because when you look behind the scenes and you work in a marketing organization, you realize the disparate data. And it's just that. It's that same last mile concept. It's like, so going back to Amazon, one of the things I experienced is like, you bought this, do you want to buy this? It's like, what Bob said, I just bought one thing, and I don't want something that looks just like the thing I just bought. You know, it's not a perishable kind of good, right? I don't just buy these things all the time. I don't buy 50 pairs of shoes or whatever it is I bought.
Well, yeah. And it's compounded, I think.
And so that last mile personalization is an issue. They can base it on your prior experience, but think of all the point of sale data and getting that connection. A lot of this has to be anonymized. And so getting to the thing, if I go to my local grocery store and I'm constantly buying something, how is Amazon going to know that unless they get that point of sale data and say, this guy's always buying this thing. And we know that person who bought it there is the same person. They'd have to know my card. They'd have to know it was me. And so that personalization could be very hard in that sort of like shopping basket final exchange.
And so
I want to go.
I had a question about, I think I might be teeing you up to continue talking about, because I actually had, I wanted to let you guys know that before I took your workshop, I had that misconception that the knowledge graph is basically, this is what I thought it was going in. I thought the knowledge graph was an ontology that is built by machines. That's what I thought it was. And I think that's a common misconception, is you think like, oh, the knowledge graph is this sort of like AI determined nodes and relationships that just like, you know, it's like a constellation that the system will just go and read a bunch of information and create a constellation from it. And
so some of that's true, although the model is not made by a machine. The model is not made by a machine, but the top level, the upper level ontology, but a lot of that, there's some companies out there, again, from this Stanford thing that's been super enlightening. There's this guy, I can't remember the name of the company, I don't want to plug it anyway, but like basically every 4 days they crawl the entire web and build a 4 trillion triple ontology. They're trying to extract information from web pages, structured information, which they use like visual analysis, natural language processing. So you go to a product page that's in Chinese, it has a picture of a whatever pillow shaped like a cat. It, you know, it's like, oh, this looks like a size, this looks like a price, this looks like an item description. It pulls it all out, puts it into the structure, and just tries to do that for the entire web. And then the tricky bits, of course, are like, I pulled Sophia's birthday from 3 places. It looks like this is the same person, but the data sources don't agree. How do I decide which is the canonical thing?
But there is still quite a bit of automation too, because there's a lot of inference. So you have to have something to exist. It doesn't just start from zero. Yeah. But once you have something, it can say, well, if I know this person works at this organization and I know the organ and this person works at the headquarters, then I know this person lives in this city or probably lives in this city. And so you can start to infer things and build connections automatically that don't need to be done manually. But you do have to have some kind of root foundation there. You need to know some things in order to infer the other things.
And that root foundation, that top level, high level ontology, that needs to be built by humans, right? And then the algorithms can potentially help fill in the instances. So basically, we're building the structure. Us humans build the structure, and then the knowledge graph is built out and expanded by algorithms. But then what was interesting is you also said then there's that last mile. So it almost seems like a sandwich. Like there's humans on one end creating that high level structure, and then computers coming in and filling out that structure, putting the meat on the bones, so to speak. And then you kind of have to have a human come in and sort of clean it up a little bit.
Yeah. But there, and in the academic world, they're even experimenting and dealing with, I think it's a little, it's not really put into practice yet, I think, but they can generate part of that structure too, to say, well, you know, I went out to the internet and I picked up all this random stuff and I've managed to cluster it into groups. And now I'm saying, oh, that must be a thing. That must be a domain.
Because the shape of
realm
this,
of knowledge.
The shape of this object and its attributes matches the shape of these objects and its attributes. So we're going to infer that it's the same kind of thing. It has a name, it has a price, it has a size, it has a whatever. And so I can automatically build that structure based on other structures that have the same shape.
Right. And I think that
there is curation involved, but Aaron's right. There is some automation of that.
Wow.
And I think if we speculate into the future, you know, people are always promising ridiculous things. And even still to this day, when we hear, oh, it automatically builds taxonomies, we kind of eye roll like, yeah, sort of, not really. But I think, you know, given what's happening and the amount of progress that's been made, I wouldn't even venture a guess. This is 10 years, 20 years. I think a lot of that will be auto-generated. And I think there's always going to be people in the loop still. But you will find more and more things where it's saying, well, you've told me this is true and you've told me this is true. So I'm going to fill in all the rest and I'm going to build ontology nodes and concepts and populate it. And you're going to verify whether that was right or not.
So
I think that's definitely the direction it'll go.
But there are still like complex modeling problems. So I wanted to go back to your Dirty Dancing example and then talk about something else that's a little harder. So Dirty Dancing was a movie. It has a soundtrack. You could probably buy a mug with the logo on it and some other stuff, right? But it was a single movie. There's no sequel, right? It has a cast, it has an IMDb page, it has structured information. So Dirty Dancing is a movie that's also a soundtrack. So what's Harry Potter? What is, not the person, not the character,
but the franchise?
This is extended, the fictional universe. Like, how do you, and I ran into this problem working with a client recently, same thing, Star Trek, Star Wars, like what is, so there's movies, there's books, there's fanfic, there's cartoons, there's merchandise, there's characters, there's abstracted things, there's multiple series, there's multiple this and that. So what is, so if I have a taxonomy of kinds of products or kinds of concepts, what is Harry Potter?
I would almost say it's a brand, but it's not really a brand because brand is something else.
Right. And so it's this like meta level of fictional product brand.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really, so like, and so how, because I need a meta level Harry Potter to attach to. So I have Harry Potter characters, Harry Potter films, Harry Potter books, Harry Potter, whatever this, Harry Potter merchandise. What's the thing that sits above that? What do I call that? And like that kind of modeling decisions, because it's so meta, as Ren would say, like that's, it's not easily solved.
With the entertainment industries, even though they may have their own jargon for it, they've done a great job with this, right? Like Disney is the master of this. If you want to use the term franchise, you have a character or a body of characters and you spin out all kinds of stuff around that. DC, Marvel, they're excellent at this kind of thing of creating this multiverse, whatever you want to call it, all these worlds. And I don't know, maybe you would call it a franchise, but they overlap and they intertwine so much. I mean, you get these crossover things that they do. Oh, it's X-Men and it's Avengers. Those are separate franchises, but they're all brought in together
under the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I have not looked at the Disney website in I don't know how many years. So I want to go audit their website and see how well they have actually connected all of these concepts. Because I know that they have products, they have movies, they have amusement parks, they have, you know, like there's the areas of amusement parks. How do they actually connect that with characters and movies and all the other things within the
world? It's a great use case for ontologies because you say, I have a domain and my domain is
Marvel
characters
Universe,
or whatever. Yeah. And you've got characters and you've got films and you've got products and you've got locations, right? You've got that's a great model for, because they can only connect to each other and you can see what the relationships would be. I mean, you can just start to visualize it mentally how these things connect, but it's very intricate. And you know, these things, they exist within this realm, but at the same time, a backpack with a character on it should not be the same as character artwork. And those are, they're the same, but they're different.
Yeah.
So that's where ontologies really help to sort out and model. I mean, when they describe ontologies, we often talk about it as really mimicking a mental model,
right?
And how you think about things. And that's what you're trying to do is replicate the world onto a 3D virtual space.
Well, and then you throw products into that, like, because concepts and products are like pretty tricky relationship. Like I've noted before that product taxonomies aren't really the same as concept taxonomies. They don't follow the same kinds of rules. Like you can't, so there's no reason, who brought this up the other day? I can't remember. There's no reason that a hunting knife and a kitchen knife should be in the same category in your product ontology, even though they're both knives. Like in a strict ontology or a strict taxonomy, knives are knives and they're both subclasses of knives. And that's useful because if you want to do any reasoning about what knives are, you got to do it that way. Mm-hmm. Product taxonomies or ontologies are organized by where people are going to find things. Right. And I even saw, oh God, there was one going recently around on Twitter. I can't remember what it was. And like some kitchen implement toasters or something were under women. And it was like just this shocking thing, but like
I want to know who you're following on Twitter. I'm going to follow everybody that you're following.
But product vocabularies don't follow the logic of strict vocabularies because they have to follow. They have to follow the logic of the discourse, if you will, of the user. If you don't put it where people are going to find it, they're not going to buy it. Mm-hmm.
And this is where I think that, you know, if we talk about the evolution of a taxonomy is hierarchical and you can do polyhierarchy, a thing can exist in more than one place, right? But ontologies, you really start to think of it as a graph, right? That it's nodes and it's points and it's interconnected and it's sort of this 3D shape of interconnected relationships. Then it starts to make more sense. So I worked at a retail organization as a consultant, in Atlanta, actually. They had a product and one half of it was literally one unit and a half of it was a toaster and the other half was a coffee maker. And I thought, this is a great taxonomy example because do you put it under miscellaneous appliances? Because it's not just a coffee maker and it's not a toaster, it's both. You put it in both places because that's where, of course, UX comes in and you have to test and say, what do people think of? Do they think, well, when I look for a coffee maker, I should find one with a toaster attached? Should I, you know, do I look under weird product combinations? Where do people look? And that's where you get into the user experience side, definitely, and start to model it. But the great thing about his ontology is it can live in all those places. Right. It's like, well, if I look up a coffee maker, it's there. If I look up a toaster, it's there. If I look up weird appliances, it's there.
So this leads me to another really technical tactical question on labels. So I have two more labeling questions before I want to let you guys go, because we've been here, like this has been an awesome conversation and we could keep going for another 2 hours for sure. But on that vein, so I need a word. So, and what I'm calling it now, what am I calling it now? I'm calling it either a shared metadata or shared taxonomy. So I sort of asked this in the workshop and I want to dig in a little bit deeper and see what your answer is. So if I have a piece of metadata, let's say category, it's category metadata that I can put on recipes and I can put on ingredients, and I can even put on users. And that's the category. It's a dietary restriction category. So gluten-free, dairy-free, paleo, kosher.
So it could be a recipe. It could be an ingredient. It could be a consumer of it.
But yeah. I want to use that same list, that same controlled vocabulary of items to help match these things up, right? So It's a piece of metadata that is actually the values are shared across multiple different objects. What would you call that?
I don't know if I'd give it a specific name. I mean, it's about how you model it. So for something like that, if it's being reused and it's a list of control values, it could be its own scheme or vocabulary itself, and it lives, and maybe it's just a flat list. It could also be a property to say, well, the property itself, that named metadata field, belongs in a lot of places, and those values might be the same. You still have to control it somewhere. You still have to.
Yeah, and I want it controlled in one place. It. So when the next new diet comes out of like,
you can put it there.
Salt free. Right. I want to put it there, and I want it to be able to apply to all three of those. It needs a name. I disagree. We need to have a name for that because it comes up all the time when I'm teaching this stuff. Of like, oh, what we need here is you basically need that piece of metadata and needs to be shared between these things to help match them up. So I can say, based on this user saying I'm gluten-free, dairy-free, paleo, only show me recipes that are tagged gluten-free, dairy-free, and paleo. And if I go search ingredients, it needs to also say like, oh, I'm looking at white flour. These are the dietary restrictions that match this.
Yeah. Again, I can only speak from my own experience that I don't know if I would give that a specific name other than to say, because in faceted taxonomies and ontologies, you do reuse elements from different places and you interconnect between them, that to me, when I think about that in a mental model, that's just another scheme where these things live and that they can be related back to concepts in all of the other schemes.
Yeah, I don't have any problem calling that a little taxonomy. I mean, it's probably not very big. It probably has a little bit of hierarchy. Right, because everything that's vegan is vegetarian, but not everything that's vegetarian is vegan. Mm-hmm. So I'd probably call that a little taxonomy,
It could be big though. It's not the size that I'm concerned with. It's the fact that it's shared, and there are categories that are not shared within a system. So I have an object, and if it's and even within product. So I give an example of let's say I have a site that sells three different products. It sells handbags and it sells watches. And let's just say handbags and watches. So that's all I sell in but they're both products. So I might have a product base that has, you know, like the price and all the shared pieces of content and metadata. And then I can say, well, material. So material for watch and material for handbag, the values are going to be completely different. They're both going to have material, but they'll have a different list. So that's one thing where you have the same piece of metadata, which is material, but different values for different objects. And then
this is exactly why the taxonomy team at Etsy will never run out of stuff to do, because every time a product category gets big enough to require its own attributes, so size of sheets and size of shirts and size of watches are not the same thing, although they all might have a category called size. Now, I might name those different elements just to keep them from getting conflated somehow on the back end. So I might have watch size, bedding size, clothing size, or something. But like, so now you have an element that's dietary restriction that's shared by a bunch of different objects. So what I would do is do the opposite. I would name the field, the attribute field for each of those objects, the same thing, so that it's easier for me to connect the dots for them, both systematically and from a human readable level. So that when I have I think you just call that a little taxonomy, not little, but like a taxonomy that informs that metadata field.
So we do have a notion too that's sort of like this. It's a little tangential and it's specific to our software. That's why I don't really think there's an industry term for it. But we have this notion of what we call in one of our software components a collection. And a collection is a group of labels that you can apply to any concept no matter where it exists on any taxonomy. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot like a property or an attribute where you're saying, hey, it doesn't matter where this concept appears, attach gluten-free to it. Mm-hmm. And gluten-free might be, a particular food item and ingredient. It could be a user. And so we have this notion of a collection. I don't think that's sort of universally accepted. I think it's particular to our product.
Yeah, some people would call it a facet. I mean, and I think that might be a useful way to think about it. It's just kind of an abstract notion, but it does what you're saying, which is apply some kind of proper label across object types that you can group all together. So if I have a bunch of products, right, and for whatever reason, God knows, I want to know which ones are red, I could have a category or a collection or a facet called red or color that's going to group all the red ones together. And it doesn't matter if they're cars or pizza cutters. They still have the property red. So yeah. I think some people think of that as a facet.
Yep.
Right. And that's very common in faceted taxonomies because you do have attributes. And this is very common in the product world because they share attributes. Right. So length and width may not be the same scale in different products. But for the most part, if you say, well, we deal in inches and feet and we live in the United States, like that can be used for so many different things, right? Like it's either in inches or it's in feet, and you can apply it to 10,000 different products, and it's one common list of these values. That to me is still, yeah, that's a facet to say, well, here's all the lengths or all the widths or all the colors that are common and could be applied to a million different kinds of things, whether they're related or not.
So if I had to make you choose, we'll play the you must choose game. And I want to use, because I do think it's an important distinction between saying this attribute, the values are shared across objects versus this attribute is specific to this object. It's just run into my work in a long time. So I want to be able to distinguish this, saying, okay, this attribute is just for this object. We don't need to share it across multiple objects, because from a database perspective, you're going to actually design that differently, attaching the list of values to the one object versus, okay, we need to be super flexible and we need to add this to recipe and user and ingredient and maybe even blog posts. We want to use it across all of our objects within our system. So if I was going to call that something, would you want me to call that a shared taxonomy, shared metadata, or shared facet?
Oh, I was going to go with shared attribute.
Yeah. So we have this notion in the ontology world of predicates and properties, yes, right? And a property is that value. And basically the way that we design our software follows that notion where you have this bucket of relationships and properties that you can use, and you assemble that into what we call a template, could also be called a class. And you're saying this bundle of metadata, this bundle of attributes and predicates is only allowed for things in this scheme or these kinds of concepts. So we do have a name for that. Again, I don't know if it's sort of universally accepted, but this bundle of particular properties and predicates that can only be used in one context, we bundle as a template.
So, but what I'm hearing from Sophia is that we need an attribute on attributes that says shareable, yes, no.
Like unique local attribute. Like, is it local or is it shareable to that particular?
Is it shareable or is it unique, so that you can restrict an attribute? No one else uses this attribute. If you need a size field, go get your own damn size field. This size field is for extension cords.
Yes.
A meta attribute that says.
I might go with attributes then.
Well, I use attributes to also just describe any kind of structure within the object. So I use attributes for metadata or what I call core content. So like a description is also an attribute, but that's not metadata. Yeah.
Why not?
Because it's unstructured. So I specifically say metadata is for sorting and filtering. Description is the data. It's not metadata. It's the actual, it's the unique identifier of that thing. So I differentiate those two. And the reason I differentiate those two is specifically for the purpose of, I want to be able to see in an object map, we actually color code those things. I want to be able to see, okay, what is your metadata? Because if I have a big ass list of these things, how am I going to sort and filter? and I can search with description or unique ID or title name, but I can't do any kind of smart sorting or filtering.
Right. Yeah, so see, I'm not that narrow with the metadata. I mean, to me, description is perfectly valid metadata.
It's just not controlled.
It's not controlled and you can't sort by it, but it's a field. It's a descriptive field that holds content. So that to me is still metadata. So,
me too, but that's okay. I would just call them controlled versus uncontrolled metadata.
Okay. So, I'm calling all those attributes. So that, everybody listening to this is probably just like, oh my God, nobody can agree on these terms, but
we need a meta taxonomy is what we need.
Well, did you see that I created an ontology of these terms and put them up on Twitter, and I didn't get the level of conversation that I wanted to, but actually like, what is it? I want to see a model of the words. Maybe you guys can create this. I have ontology, objects, attributes, and taxonomy, and how do all of those things connect? And also metadata would be another one on there. And I mean, and I actually connected taxonomy directly to attribute, not to the object or to the ontology, because the attribute, whether it's, so you have an object recipe and you have a metadata category, the taxonomy ladders up to the attribute category.
Yeah, you're using the object to talk about the thing itself, whether that's a document or a collection of metadata fields.
The real world thing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah. I found your post.
we'll slip that in between all the other work items we've got to meta taxonomize this.
So we're going to call this if you had to choose between shared taxonomy and shared metadata.
So, I guess the distinction there, that's confusing me is we seem to be conflating like the field that holds the value and the constraint or list of things that populates that field. And I want to know which one you're talking about.
So I'm talking about that list of, they kind of go hand in hand. So we have size is what I would call the metadata. So you have size metadata on your, but then the list of values that we have, 1 inch, 2 inch, 3 inch, 4 inch for our, our paring knives. But then for our hunting knives, it's, we use millimeters or something like that because of, so those would be the list of values or the restrictions and the structure around that metadata. Numbering isn't a great example. The color is a better example. So you have color metadata on your products. The taxonomy is that list of have blue, yellow, green, red, and then underneath green, you have seafoam green, teal. That's what I would call a taxonomy, but I would attach that actually to the piece of metadata. And then by proxy, it gets attached to the object.
Yeah, I'd still go with Bob and say that that's a taxonomy, or you could call it, if it's literally has no hierarchy to it, I'd call it a controlled list.
Whatever, but mm-hmm. I would just
list the values.
Yeah. Numbers are a special case because the constraints are different. You don't just have a list of numbers, so they use what they call domain and range, and you can specify that it has to be a number, then it has to be. So I have a list of astronomical objects. Those objects have a brightness. Those brightness are measured in, I don't remember what the unit was, some unit, and they are between 10 and 100 or whatever, and they have to be the values of multiples of 10. So that's a different, slightly different kind of, because why make a list of every number that you can think of? That doesn't make any sense, right?
Right,
so,
right, yeah.
The principle's the same, though, of constraining the field.
Okay,
I'm starting to run up against my other call.
Thank you guys so much for talking to me for so long.
Well, I want to stay and do it. This is fun, but
we'll definitely need to do a follow-up because we didn't even get into like artificial intelligence and chatbots and how all of this connects to that, because it does. So I have, at least 10 more questions. So we'll definitely do a follow-up. Thank you guys so, so much. I'm really excited to re-listen to this one and like take notes on this conversation. But you guys have a wonderful rest of your day and thanks again.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you as well.
This is fantastic.
All right. Yeah, y'all have a good one. Have a good rest of your week. Thank you so much for listening. I truly hope you enjoyed this episode. please visit objectorientux.com/podcast for show notes. Our soundtrack is Fighter by Ruby Vell, courtesy of Sugaroo Records. Happy OUXing!